Well, welcome back to the second session. And as mentioned, we have an hour for you to address questions to the panel. There are two roving microphones, so we might, there'll be a sort of a temporary pause while I think Giles will bring a microphone over to you. But really, floor's open for questions. Or comments even, yes. There's Nick. And if I'd just like to say, if you'd like to say your name and your affiliation, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Nicholas Arbuthnot. I'm a student on the sustainability course. It's for Professor Bannister. And it's about scale. And when does it become a point where an advantage of scale in a city begins to wear off or begins to reduce? Or does it, has that happened yet?
Well, yes, so we'll take one question at a time. So if you'd like to address your question, you know, to the individual or the panel as a whole, but David, if you'd like to respond. Okay.
I mean, it's a really tricky problem, I think, what you've raised here in terms of when cities become, in a sense, dysfunctional. And I think this is already occurring in certain areas. I mean, it's not already, it certainly is already occurring in many situations. That I mean, there's one thing that there's up to about say 5, 6, 7 million in the northern cities. They seem to work quite well. I mean, the larger cities. Where it becomes a real problem is perhaps where cities begin to merge with each other. And there are a whole series of issues that are raised. And it's not just that you're sort of getting one city, as it were, encroaching on another city. There's a sort of physical side to it. There's probably a governance side to it in terms of how the city relates to each other organizationally. There may be sort of discontinuities in terms of the infrastructure that's already there because they've been implemented under different jurisdictions. I don't think it's just a size issue. It's a much more complex issue than just size, but it's an amalgamation of factors that make it, and this is happening, make it really difficult to happen. So the example I gave of the Nanjing Shanghai area with an 83 million population, that is happening. Shanghai is works reasonably well in one sense, at least, in that it has its satellite structure and it has now reasonable links with Nanjing, but it's all the other areas, all the other cities within the area that are causing the problems. And also it's then saying, well, where is the center of that development? You have multiple centers. And this has caused huge problems in terms of analysis, is that we're quite good at looking at single-centered cities, but when they become polycentric or multiple-centered cities, it becomes much harder to look at how the structure is actually working.
Thank you. You might be interested in following up the work of Professor Jeffrey West. He's a physicist by training, former president of the Santa Fe Institute in the United States, and incidentally an associate fellow of the Institute for Science, Innovation and Society here at Oxford University. And Jeff's done some very interesting work looking at issues of scale both in the natural and the social worlds. And one of the things that is intriguing, and I don't remember the details, I'm afraid, but you'll obviously be able to check this up through the web, was that whereas in fact in the physical world there are limits beyond which you start to get a diminution of functionality with increase of scale. His argument, at least, is that you don't find this with urban development. Now, that's obviously a contentious finding, but it's one that he has researched quite extensively and would be interesting for you to look at if that's a topic that intrigues you.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. Do we have another question from the floor? Well, yes, there are.
Robin Hickman from the Transport Studies Unit. I'd be interested in the panel's views on...
I'm sorry, I can't hear. Can you talk right into the microphone? So
yeah, is that...
That's better, thank you.
I'd be interested in the panel's views on achieving carbon reduction targets as we're signing up to at the national level, whether they're likely, how we could make them more likely, bearing in mind problems with path dependency and social and lifestyle behaviours that we have?
Well, I'm willing to have a go at that because I think I have a controversial position. Personally, my view is that the carbon reduction targets that are embodied in the Climate Change Act are nonsensical, and I think simply to attain them, to put us on track over the next 10 years, we'd have to be building something like 15 nuclear power stations a year for the next 10 years to get onto that right that trajectory that's laid out in the Climate Change Act. That clearly isn't going to happen. Nothing near that is going to happen, in fact. I've long been a critic of the idea of targets and timetables for dealing with climate change, despite the fact that I've also, for an equally long time, regarded it as a very serious problem and challenge. So I'm in no sense a climate change denier. But I think it's much more important to pursue policies which establish the direction of travel for both mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions and, incidentally, for improving adaptation to the inevitable climate change that's going to happen, than it is to set targets that you can't possibly conceivably reach. With respect to energy, I think that we need a massive investment in energy R&D, particularly in the demonstration and deployment rather than the initial front-end research and development. We need this for a number of reasons, which is that if we are going to have any sort of significant large central generation, and Malcolm was suggesting that perhaps we could move away from that, but I think that's not going to happen rapidly and it's not going to be universal. There are certain systemic gaps in our current technology. For example, we do not have integrated grid storage for intermittent generating sources. We don't have good ways of storing power from windmills and solar generators when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. At the moment, we do things like pump storage, where we pump water up a hill and then let it run down through a turbine. This is not an efficient way to deal with these things, and it's not something that's highly sensitive to the needs of the grid. We need to be looking at smart grids as well. These are missing bits of technology. And even with the bits of technology that we do have, and we do have some of them, solar cells have improved, I think Malcolm would agree, remarkably in the last few years, but they're still too expensive. And the notion that somehow or other we're going to drive people into buying very much more expensive kit by imposing cap and trading systems to put the prices up, I think is mistaken. If we look at things like the history of the fuel escalator tax, we look at what has happened in France, we look even at Bill Clinton's, his picture's on the wall over there, he's probably wincing, attempts to introduce even a 5 cents a gallon gas tax in his first term of office, and we saw how those failed. We're not going to get people to start changing their behavior unless we can bring the cost of the alternative technologies down to something which is at least in the ballpark of being competitive with what we have. At that point, you can increase your carbon tax to try to accelerate, as part of the end game, accelerate the pace of the switch to the alternatives. But the notion that we're going to drive this at this front end by high prices, I think, is also misguided. Just finally on adaptation, I think we have... Adaptation was for many years a dirty word. It was a bit like talking with Southern Baptists in the United States, where I used to live, about sex education in schools. It was a bad idea because you'd encourage the kids to think it's all right to go on doing bad things. But I think if we look at things like the Hurricane Katrina event, which, by the way, there's no evidence that that was caused or exacerbated by climate change, no matter what anybody might assert. But what it does show is, in fact, how poorly adapted, even in the well-developed world, we are to deal with the consequences of climatic variability. And it seems to me that we should be putting a lot more effort into improving the adaptive capability of cities, going beyond things like the Thames Barrier for the cities in the developed world, and thinking about how we're going to protect vulnerable populations in places like Bangladesh, where, by the way, the Bangladeshis import rubble. They import other people's demolished buildings because they don't even have stone to build roads. They're not going to be building massive barriers against sea level rise or going to be able to elevate their ground level. So we've got to become much more attentive, I think, to how we protect our cities against existing climatic variability, which, by the way, will also enhance our capacity to deal with longer term climate change.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I'd add to that. I mean, in the sense that it's probably a developed and a developing world dimension to this as well. I mean, the carbon reduction targets is something that is very much in the developed world sort of conversations. It's not in the developing world. I've been talking recently with people even in South Africa and places, which is in a sense really advanced. It's not even on the agenda there to actually talk about carbon. They're not interested in carbon. They don't really know what carbon is, and to actually then have a reduction target. So my guess is that it's very much a first world. It's very much a rich country, rich cities in thing. And also that Steve's talked about the supply. We must look at the demand side as well in the rich cities to look at ways in which we can consume less and consume more efficiently than we actually do at the present time. So it's not just the sourcing of the energy and things, it's the way in which we actually use that energy. And that comes back to this interface between technology and behavior. And how can we bridge that gap between what we should be doing in one sense and what we do in the real sense? And that's where there seems to be a great discontinuity, and that perhaps is where we need to be investing a lot of research or a lot of thinking as well.
Well, yeah, just to follow that up, I am the major change I think that's happened in applied mathematics in my career has been the switch from having its most important interface with physical and biological science towards social science. And so I mentioned burglary, for example, as an example of collective behavior, which is only just being started to be understood in any quantitative way. And the way in which people use devices is a perfectly good other example of that. But one inevitably gets into questions of psychology, which are very difficult to quantify. And, well, it's part of the difficulty of this interface between quantitative physical science and, say, architecture. And if I could just say one other thing, which might be sort of relevant, there is also an emerging interface between mathematics and computer science and entertainment. And I was recently talking to the research director of DreamWorks, who has pictures every bit as beautiful as Norman's pictures, which are created by a vast team, which primarily consists of computer scientists, but also engineers and physicists. The computer scientists create the pictures, and the engineers and physicists sort of check them out to see that they look right, although they're never really scientifically right. And I feel that that interface has some analogies with what we heard last night.
So if I come back to the original question, which is about carbon reduction in transport, I think one has to look at it at a number of levels. The first level is obviously the technologies that potentially can be used to attack that particular issue. And one can start off by thinking the first level of technology you can start thinking of is what are the fuels going to be used. And obviously there's biofuels, there's using hybridization, there's hybridizations with plug-in hybrids, with plug-in technology for electric, and then there's full electric vehicles, and then there's hydrogen. Each one of those has a number of issues associated with them, not least of which is the resource that's consumed to make the original component that you need to then drive the vehicle with. But they do have potentials to make a significant difference. And for instance, electric vehicles have got an opportunity of going down to carbon emissions of something like 20 grams of CO2 per kilometer is achievable right now. All you need to do is go and buy a Mini E and go and drive it in France, and you can achieve that. You take the same vehicle and you go and drive it in China, and you're running around about 180 to 200 grams of CO2 per kilometer. So the difficulty is that you are needing to change the way the grid works and the way the amount of carbon that goes into the grid if you want to go down the pure EV route. If you go down and look at the biofuel route, again, there's problems of saying how much land do you use for biofuels, how much do you use for other resources such as creating oxygen, such as creating food. And I think there's a real challenge in that area there. The second level of changes that could well come along is what I would call the way the whole vehicle is actually designed is probably the wrong way around. And that is to say, it's crazy that you take a 1.5 to 2 ton vehicle around to carry somebody, like I'm about 110 kilos, and I'm heavier than most people here, but why do we have a 10-to-1 ratio of mass required to, you know, to perform a function to what's actually doing, you know, to actually deliver that function? So I think there's going to be a whole move to lightweighting, which is going to make us another substantial improvement. And that actually has a beneficial effect that things like the size of batteries then needs to decrease, the amount of biofuels you need decreases. So that takes us, also helps us down that route. The third thought is to say, why do we do mobility in the first place, and what is mobility about? And that starts to become very interesting, because then you start to say, we've developed this weird society where we buy a vehicle based on either male jewelry type of concept, so it's about status symbols, or it's about, once a year I'm going to drive to the south of France, and therefore I need a vehicle that does that. And 99% of the time, it actually just drives me 10 miles for my commute. And so the question is to say, can we actually rethink the way mobility happens and say, can we actually diversify the mix of vehicles that we use in order to achieve a particular functionality? And that starts to go into a whole lot of different business type environments and say, how do you actually create the business infrastructure to enable that to happen? That also then ties into the whole city side of things, is to say, why do we need to travel the long distances in the first place? And that starts to become interesting, and then you start to look at areas such as using advanced ICT type of technologies in immersive environments, where you can start to have three-dimensional video conferencing, and that then enables you to actually do the long-distance travel in a lot more sustainable way. So I think there are multiple routes to that. Are they all going to happen next year? No. But we know that some manufacturers are already talking about that by 2014, something like between 50 and 60% of all new vehicles that they make will either be plug-in hybrids or electric. So there is a definite trend towards doing that. If you look at places like Japan, David will know better than I do, but there the size of vehicles decreased dramatically, and therefore is becoming a lot more efficient, especially on the lightweighting. And if you look at the business environments, you can either think of streetcar or zipcar, those alternative modes of supplying personal mobility are starting to come through. So I see there is trends moving in the right direction. Whether we're going to meet those targets, I don't know. But we're moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Malcolm. Do we have another question? Michael, yes, thank you.
Michael Keith, the ESRC Centre on Migration Policy and Society. There's a simple question with an explanation. And the simple question is, how does the way we think about land impinge on our prospects for sustainability of cities, but specifically in terms of lock-in, of transport, of innovation, of mathematical predictability. The explanation, I guess, is in part about the tragedy of the commons, but in those models of the megacities of the future, we know that there are very different models of property rights and ownership that are being invoked in China and the US, for example. So in China, you buy not property as such, but land rights or the right to use that property for a period of time, which is a different notion of ownership altogether from the one conventionally in the West. Now, on the one hand, this might be about, if you like, the end of the Washington consensus, as it's sometimes talked about, and the emergence of maybe a Beijing consensus. But in some ways, I suppose it's about how we think about externalities in generating sustainable cities, not just in the megacities and the metacities, but also, even if you take something like Crossrail in London, mm-hmm. We have now sophisticated models to think about commodifying the future, if you like, through value capture, through planning obligations, through 106, and you think about real estate in terms of hope values and the ways in which we can have nice stations.
Thank you, Michael. David, do you want to lead?
Not really. it's such a big and complex issue. It's very difficult to talk, I think, in generalities about it because of different sorts of cultures, different locations, different sorts of size of cities and things. But I think one of the crucial issues here is the allocation of land between what we might call private ownership in terms of who actually owns it and the use of the what we might call the public domain and who actually has the rights to use that. And my guess is that if we're moving towards a sustainable city, we have to be absolutely clear who has the rights to use what is available in terms of the land. So my area, for instance, in transport, is saying that certain parts of the land would be allocated to cars, and that is for their use. It might not be for the whole day, it might be for part of the day. But then it's also being able to find ways of saying that this land is for the use of pedestrians, for people, for cyclists, for other types of use. And I think this is where many cities actually fail in terms of that defining whose right it is to use that particular, as it were, right of way. And thinking now with ICT and other areas is that we can be much more creative about the use of land. And if we can then transfer ownership from as it were, to the people who live there, the communities or something like that, then that land tends to become much better used in terms of the types of uses, but also in terms of the engagement, the fact that it would be used for play activities for children, for all sorts of things that it wasn't used for before. In developing world, it can be used for markets, it can be used for street activities, but that's not exclusively for those that type of situation. So that's the common. But also then we have the other side of it, which you're saying is that on, say, mega projects or on big projects, that we actually have substantial value uplift. And it's saying, right, well, who actually should benefit from that uplift? There's a lot of literature around this and in different sorts of schemes and saying, how can we tie the people in to the beneficiaries actually paying part of the premium that they get from the land or property value uplift back into the public purse? So it gets round your original sort of comment of the sort of the lock-in type situation, which the benefits accrue to the private investor or the private owner rather than to the public side. In this country, we've not been very good at doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think my first observation is would be to suggest that one shouldn't get too hung up on the question of ownership. It's the question of the use rights and access rights that are critical. After all, you know, you talked about a situation in China where you don't own the land, you buy use rights. How different is that from leasehold, which is a well-established land tenure system here in the UK? We also have the situation where we have privately owned land where there are public access rights, the public. The right to roam, for example, is a case of that. So I think it's not so much the actual ownership structure. We can get hung up on one-size-fits-all formulae. I mean, you know, the work of De Soto, who said if we gave everybody in the favelas a certificate of title to their land so that they could that they built their shanty on, that this would then be the means by which that they would raise the entire economy up out of poverty. I think that's probably far too simplistic, and we need to be cautious about latching on to particular schemes and ideas. And I think, if anything, the thing to do is to keep a multiplicity of forms of land ownership and access and management, and to have the flexibility, the key thing, and this is one of the themes of our research program, is the flexible city, is how do you develop the flexibility to change land uses when it is in the social interest to do so, and when do you provide stability and counter that against the stability of expectation that people need to make large investments in infrastructure and so on that is on land? And I think that's really the key question, rather than getting hung up on any particular ownership regime.
Thank you.
I'm not a land specialist at all, but I'm...
Neither am I.
Nor am I.
Michael, let's make that clear.
Probably even less than you. But I think the only comment that I'd make is to say that often land in cities is designed to maximise, and designed to maximise for a particular opportunity, rather than to optimise for society's benefit. And a typical example is that I just come back from Tianjin a while back, and one of the things which was very stark while I was both in Beijing and Tianjin, is there was no wildlife around. And that to me was a shock to my system. It's the first time I've been out there. I was thinking just how lucky we are in this country to have optimized our land use for both economic benefit, but also for social well-being.
Well, the only contribution mathematics might be able to make is to make a model for property developers, I would say, which may have disastrous predictions.
They have those.
Thank you. They have done.
They don't have those. And they make disastrous predictions.
On that note, Professor Tindixon has a question.
If you speak into the end of the mic rather than over the top of it, it works better.
Like you're on X Factor, that's it.
I didn't realise that because I was speaking last, I had to answer every question first so that everybody else gets a chance to collect their thoughts. But I'm not sure what the answer is to this one, Tib. Obviously, I think that the economy is going to have to move towards, I mean, not just our economy, but other economies, towards investing in jobs that can be called in some way green. I'm not quite sure what that the term actually means, if it's in the production of, you know, wind turbines or something like that. That would be part of it. It's a broad definition. Where I'm more dubious is whether that necessarily leads to growth. And to my mind, again, that revolves around, if we take a national, a fairly narrow definition of growth as economic growth or something like that, then perhaps it does if those jobs are new jobs rather than replacement jobs. But if we take a broader notion about sort of human welfare or something like that as a measure of growth, I don't know whether there's a link between green jobs and human welfare.
I think there's... To add to that, there's a huge issue with how you define green jobs. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a US citizen as well as a UK citizen, so I do tend to follow events in the US as best I can from a distance. With the recovery package that was passed in response to the recent economic downturn, there was a lot of emphasis in there on developing green jobs. A lot of these so-called green jobs actually were specifically created in the retrofit of older buildings, particularly schools and other kinds of public buildings, which was fine for a while, but essentially what it was doing was funding janitors to go around and put weather stripping on doors. And although that shows up as being a green job, it's obviously not a sustainable green job. And it's questionable as to the extent to which that's creating either the conditions for economic growth or really anything in terms of the long-term environmental improvement. So I think we need to get a lot better handle on what we mean by a green job before we can begin to answer your question.
I'm going to be slightly more optimistic and say that I do think that we need to make some substantial changes to the way that we use energy, the way we use water, the way we use land, the way we do mobility. And to me, I define a green job as just saying any job that moves us in the right direction to going to a far more sustainable world where we treat our natural capitals as capital rather than as a resource to consume. And therefore, I do believe that there are going to be a substantial number of green jobs that are going to be developing. I would just take, you know, for example, all the work that we've seen done by Norman Foster's Brilliant Practices, and say, I would consider most of those jobs to be green jobs because they are transforming buildings to use things in a lot better way. And therefore, they're all moving in the right direction, and therefore I would count most of those jobs to be in the green sector. I would take Steve's point into account as to say that the problem that we have, especially in our type of society, is that we tend to do things by halves. And therefore, we look at what is the cheapest way and not normally the nastiest way of trying to achieve something so that we can maximize economic benefit. And the problem that we have is that often doesn't have a long-term sustainable solution behind it. The concern that I have is that we don't go down that path, but rather go for high value, high economic value, high social value, high environmental value type of jobs where we really invest in skills so that we can really deliver the new types of world that I would aspire to.
Again, mathematics has almost nothing to say, except I did notice after recent events in the Gulf of Mexico, BP did come to Oxford University with a whole lot of ideas for how to use quantitative science in a much greener way than they had before.
Thank you. I have a question at the front. At the back, sorry, and then at the front, sorry, yes.
Chris Farmer from the Mathematical Institute. I was thinking, in terms of sustainability, we live in this beautiful city, which it actually has a lot to be desired in terms of the quality of life that we enjoy here. And I'm wondering to what extent the panel thinks that the university does enough to influence the local politicians and local businesses and also learn from them about what we might be able to do. And with that question in mind, I wonder if the panel could remark on what kind of sort of mechanisms academics can use to engage more closely with architects and others in improving our environment.
John, as a mathematician, would you like to respond?
It's very difficult, I think, in Oxford, but I think University of California in San Diego has, for the last 5 or 10 years, had a policy of being carbon neutral and energy sustainable. But of course, they have a great big campus. They can do anything they like and tear things down and replace them with more efficient buildings and so on. So I think there is a great will in the academic community to do this kind of thing. But what are we to do in Oxford? I can't think, apart from a few suggestions Malcolm might have.
So pulling on from that. Beautiful segue. I know that the university has a policy of trying to move towards meet the 2020 target, so that's a 20% reduction by 2020. The challenges are vast. I mean, our 2050 targets is basically that the whole university, including the colleges, has to have the same carbon footprint as the chemistry building does presently. And then you look around, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, the vast amount of old windows that we have, how the heck do we start to insulate that so we can start being far more thermally efficient? I mean, we're busy starting to do work at my college in Christchurch where we have over a megawatt of electrical energy consumption. And we know that we need to reduce that drastically. And the question is, how do we go about doing that? It's a real challenge. One of the other interesting things that's coming together is that there's a group starting to form around some work by Arabs to say that can we take the whole of Oxfordshire to 2050 levels by 2015? And we're looking at raising a significant amount of money to actually try and achieve that. And to me, it's quite exciting because as me as an academic, I would say that it starts to become a living laboratory where one can actually have a look around, see where the problems are, bring the best brains around, and even the odd mathematician. and actually start to say, okay, how do we start to tackle some of these issues? And if we actually live them in our own buildings and look at that, I think there's a real opportunity for us to make some substantial differences.
I think that was exactly the San Diego rationale that you actually live in this in laboratory and then you get the best possible experience.
Absolutely. So I think it's an opportunity for us to grasp, and you know, I think we need to. Hopefully, there'll be a nexus of people that will help take that idea forward.
Well, I'll give you an extra few seconds, David. But I'll just say, in terms of, I'd speak on behalf of some of the students here. So some of the postgraduates in the Sustainable Urban Development course, in the third week of October, Low Carbon Oxford was launched. So there is an initiative that's been launched in the last 4 weeks, and so there are students and staff, as well as industry, getting involved in the Low Carbon Oxford initiative. So that's almost hot off the press, but not quite. But that's happening now.
I mean, all I was going to say is that there are loads of initiatives going on, but I think perhaps the problem is how can we join up this thinking so that everybody is aware of that. And I mean, there's a lot to be said for many small-scale initiatives, but there's also something to be said for how can we actually get the bigger picture so that they're all working in the same sort of direction, and so one initiative can learn from the other initiative and that sort of thing. So the engagement part of the question from Chris is hugely important as well, and I think that is part of real part of the challenge and the part that we're perhaps not so good at thinking about.
Thank you. There was a question at the front. Two questions at the front, so I think Michael probably pitch you to the post.
Yeah. Thank you. Professor Bannister had a great quote from Jane Jacobs about cities being places of innovation, surprise, economic prosperity, and so forth. And it struck me hearing that quote that for many people in the developing world where urbanization is occurring, that would seem to be a hollow promise or something remote from where they are. And I wonder for the panel whether members could comment on what areas of change is occurring that is showing that those cities of the future that are being developed in the developing world live up to the Jane Jacobs promise.
Well, I mean, I think this goes back to what David said at the very beginning of his talk, which is, of course, historically cities have arisen organically. They have, for the most part, been built from the bottom up rather than from the top down. And I think we're seeing some brave experiments with going from the top down at the present moment, such as the one that we've been shown by Lord Foster. But nevertheless, I mean, if you go into the so-called slum communities in the third world, they don't seem to conform to the stereotype that many of us, I think, carry about. We find that there are, in fact, functioning communities. We find there are mutual support systems. We find that there are ways in which those communities actually do in many ways that admittedly low levels of physical comfort and convenience as far as we are concerned, function very well. And I think that we need to be perhaps a little more humble in assuming that we know best and that somehow or other the folks who've organized themselves need to be guided by us, whereas I think we could learn an awful lot more from the way in which they organise. I mean, I think some of the examples that Lord Foster showed yesterday, looking at the, you know, seriously going in and looking at the integration of small-scale manufacturing in the slum with the habitation and the sales and all the rest of it. I think if we start to then also understand what are the politics of those slum communities, how do their economies function and so on, we could learn an awful lot about the transition to a level of, if you like, higher technical and sort of comfort levels of comfort and convenience. I mean, clearly, the sort of statistic we had, what was it, one toilet to 14,000? Yes, you know, what that means is basically you've got outdoor defecation because they're not all using that toilet. Clearly, that's not something that's desirable. But I think in many other ways, we have a lot to gain from approaching these situations with humility and a willingness to learn.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with all of that, really. I would add 2 points, really. I think it's a two-way process. Certainly, there's a lot to be learned from what's going on there, particularly in the informal sector and how that operates. I mean, again, in my area in transport, there is bus rapid transit systems are effectively being pioneered in many of the cities, big cities in developing countries. All the informal transport, the jeepneys, and things, are things that we can actually learn from, that they have a problem and they look at it and they resolve that sort of problem. But also there is the basic infrastructure that needs to be provided somewhere in the city, things like energy, like water, like housing. It's saying, well, how can that actually be provided? And one thing I didn't mention, which I think is hugely important, is the sort of things like microfinance and other forms of finance that can actually facilitate, quite small sums of money can facilitate huge amounts of change. So it's looking at the mechanisms by which their quality of life can be improved. So perhaps the Jane Jacobs quote is not appropriate. It's appropriate for suburban US and maybe for parts of the UK and things, but not for many of the rapidly emerging cities as yet. But I would still see those cities as sort as spaces for diversity and innovation, but maybe not some of those other aspects that she was relating to. But in time.
It's not the same as India, but in Saudi Arabia, it's clear that after quite a lot of thought, I think King Abdullah did decide to put a lot of money into building half a dozen industrial cities around the coastline of Saudi Arabia. And this was part of the way, I think, that he wanted to improve society in the country and turn it into a more knowledge-based society. So I think, well, maybe, and it seems to me, it's very difficult to tell what the tribal people in the interior think of all these resources going into cities that they never really see the benefit of, which is probably what you're getting at. But I think King Abdullah is quite a wise person, and that is slightly the opposite side of the coin.
Just from a very small experience that I had many years ago when I was teaching in Soweto, was that I often found that those very poor communities and slum communities had one thing that a lot of other places I found very difficult to find elsewhere, and that was community.
Thank you. I think there was another question at the front, Giles, and then second. Thanks. Thank you.
Hello. Anne-Marie Souter in the Master's Program for Sustainable Development. Professors Rayner and Ockenden, I think, both mentioned codes, building codes, and governance and its relevance to this whole issue. And I'm wondering what kinds of suggestions or examples you might have of overcoming the existing bureaucratic inertia, let's say, to incorporating new building technologies, when on the one hand you have a government agency telling you to cut this and cap that, and then on the other hand you have a different agency governing codes telling you that you have to build technology-dependent buildings. And then, given that, how would you reconcile that with public safety when you're experimenting with building innovation?
Well, I think building codes are obviously enormously important. One of the statistics that stuck in my mind, or factoids that stuck in my mind for a very long time, is that during Hurricane Andrew, there was one builder in Homestead, Florida, that did not lose a single roof. You know the name of this builder. Anybody guess? Or it was Habitat for Humanity, the self-build charity run by Jimmy Carter. So clearly, when they were asked, "What's your secret?" they shrugged and said, "We built a code." So clearly, having sound building codes that are uniformly enforced can be extremely important. Of course, there's also the downside, which is that you can have situations where building codes actually preclude innovation. A very homely example, I had a friend in Maryland who wanted to build a new home with composting toilets. And he was unable to get permission to install composting toilets because they didn't conform to the building code and the sanitation requirements, and he was forced to put in an old-fashioned septic tank in the end. The other thing is that, of course, the existence of building codes is not the only thing that I think locks us into a certain conservatism. There's also the question of the dissemination of skills in the building trades. I don't know if people here have had the experience of trying to build an addition to your home in such a way that you want to employ some of the latest building techniques that embody more efficient uses of energy and water and so on. That can be extremely difficult because the builder wants to put in what the builder knows how to put in. And one of the biggest challenges, I think, is how do we effectively disseminate the necessary skills to the people who are going to actually execute construction and have influence over what goes into buildings to ensure that we have the flexibility to innovate. Once again, we're getting back to this whole question, which I think is central to the theme of our program here, which is the flexible city, which is how can you create situations where you can actually innovate and change as demands arise, whilst at the same time preserving the elements of a community and a society that you think give somewhere a sense of place and a sense of value. So I think, yes, building codes are important. They can be a drawback. Sometimes they contain absurdities. I recently had a small building job where I had to put up a particularly thick cavity wall and then bash a great big hole in it for an air vent to ensure that there was sufficient ventilation for the gas boiler, which undid all of the benefits of doing the cavity wall. So there's that question as well, which I think is whether the codes are in fact themselves consistent and sensible.
Well, I didn't really have much to say about building codes, but I think if I was going to try and answer this question in any sort of quantitative way, I'd want to make some sort of model for the societal environment. And in the Cotswolds, you try and put a solar cell on your roof and you're ostracized from the village, as it were. But if you're in the middle of Oxford in a mobile community, you can probably replace your sash windows and things like that without too much trouble. So I think it would exactly depend on where you are, but sometimes it seems to me that they can be so restrictive and so retrograde the attitudes of the local community that you're just never going to get anywhere. We might as well not have this meeting at all.
Nothing more to add.
David, do you want to? There's a question on the second row there as well.
Hello, Philip Reel. I'm part of the Sustainable Urban Development Programme. I'm looking for a silver lining here around the whole issue of mass urbanisation. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the following. Is there any advantage in mass for nature in terms of mass urbanisation? Do you think there's a better chance of maintaining undisturbed natural footprint, biodiversity, fragile ecosystems with this mass exodus of people from rural areas into urban areas? Or are cities going to remain, will the impact remain the same regardless of the redistribution of people? Are they going to remain as hungry and as demanding on sort of nature as an ecosystem? Thank you.
I think the answer to that depends on what kinds of socio-technical systems and innovations we are able to put together in order to support these urban forms. Clearly, the concentration of population out of rural areas presents the possibility of what's called freeing land for nature. That's one possibility. But it really depends on what are the agricultural systems that we're going to use to feed people, what are the transportation systems we're going to use to move people between these locations and within these locations, so on and so forth. So I'm afraid that in a sense the silver lining is the unsatisfactory answer. It depends, but I think we also know what are some of the things that it depends on. I would also add that I think in many ways we do know that there are, in any case, advantages in gathering people together in concentrated communities. We know, for example, that disaster relief is a lot easier and a lot more effective. It's much easier and quicker to reach people in situations of earthquakes and other events of that sort. We have the ability to get other kinds of advantages from the benefits of scale of concentrating people together. But I'm afraid ultimately it depends on the choices we make.
David, yeah.
Yeah, I think also perhaps it's an issue of organization. I mean, I don't think there's any sort of silver lining here, but I mean, we can also look at cities and mass urbanization and look at ways in which we can get green into the city, which is, I think, hugely important as well in terms of what people actually do within the cities. So some cities are designed around the sort of finger plan where you have green wedges that come in, some have a lot of green spaces in them, some have green corridors within them or blue corridors, so you've got water environments rather than just sort of green environments. But it also relates back to the question that was asked earlier about having access to that and the rights as to who owns that or who, not necessarily owns it, but who has use of it, and this difference between public and private space and whether that's green or other sorts of spaces within the city. Access is hugely important, that perhaps we don't need a lot of gardens and things within cities, but we can have collective areas that we can use if we want to have our allotments and things, and other types of areas that we can use for recreation or areas in which we will get wildlife or different types of habitats. So the city is not just, as it were, concrete. The city is a space in which is a living space, and that also has presumably benefits in terms of environmental quality within the city and fixing carbon and various other things that can be done. So mass urbanization, I think, is something that can be done creatively, but that requires institutional and organizational structures that have some sort of vision for the city, some sort of view as to how that city can actually develop. And I think that perhaps is one of the major challenges that many of these rapidly growing cities face, is that this pressure on space and how can we make the best use of that space. And that space isn't just being used for the highest value in terms of the development value, but also in terms of recreational and other types of value that people who live in that city might gain from that space.
Thank you.
Well, I think there is a silver lining here from my perspective, in that theoretical ecology is just evolved out of all recognition in the last 40 years, and we understand so much more about how ecosystems work in a scientific way than we did 40 years ago, and all kinds of surprising things are being thrown up from that. And I think it's crucial to build that knowledge into the sort of thing, mismanagement that you've been talking about.
If we care enough about it, we'll make it happen.
On that note of positive note, is there another question there? Great. Well, on that positive note, thank you, Malcolm. I'd like to thank the floor for the questions, and I'd like to thank the presenters for the presentations and their responses. But it's just on 5 o'clock on the dot, so it's with great pleasure now I'd ask Lord Foster to conclude this afternoon's session with a closing statement.
Can I go there? Oh.
If you want to.
I'll feel strange if I've got my back to you.
I think the microphone lectern's working, so if you'd like to.
Do these?
As the ultimate non-specialist, I find it a slightly awesome task to sum up the work of so many distinguished specialists. In no particular order, Masdar, perhaps not surprisingly, was mentioned again. And I think it's probably important to mention, and perhaps I didn't state the obvious last night, that it's not a city, it's not at the city scale. I mean, it might be called a kind of mini city within a city, but it really is a laboratory in that sense. And what I showed last night was really the first stage of a university. And within that master plan, there will be many architects involved. But it does only take you up to a certain scale. I mean, 100, 1,000. And in a kind of randomness, there was one question about scale. And if you take the whole concept of processing waste and converting it to energy, you need really a catchment of about 500,000 inhabitants to be able to do that successfully. And this is completely changing the order of the notes that I made, but just at the opening of the last week, the kind of official opening of the university, the Masdar Institute, which is totally devoted to the study of renewable energies. The students who, the intake of the students from about 40 nations, and there are 100 students now, and they have to meet the requirements of MIT because it's tied in with MIT, and eventually, as it expands, with other universities. So anybody graduating as a postgraduate student there is MIT accredited. And as we walked around to look at one or two of the projects that the students were working on, one of them was waste management. And this links across quite a number of the questions about governance and tariffs. And a rather interesting connection for me was that I went on after the opening to a trustees meeting of the university. And the head of the university said, what's really interesting is after a few weeks, already 90% of the students are so into what they're doing here that they want to stay in Abu Dhabi and have the opportunity to put their research into reality. And that suddenly struck me that there was the potential for a real lifestyle changing opportunity, because one of the dilemmas that anybody working in these emerging nations is the whole question of management. So you can have the ruling families, you can have, they can be and are indeed very enlightened. So if you take Abu Dhabi, this is an extraordinary initiative. And if you parallel that with the island, with the five universities, it's probably the biggest cultural project that's ever been undertaken, bringing in the Louvre and national museums and so on. But the dilemma is that the management is through a kind of group of expats who are very much about short-termism. So you're lucky if you're dealing with somebody for more than 2 years. And these are the people on the ground who are managing the projects. And the difficulty is that their point of reference is not a kind of revolutionary experimental project. It's what they've been working on, the shopping center down the road here, or a typical air-conditioned glass office block, which is the transplant into. So I think that the potential to link in an emerging nation a research and development unit, which then feeds back into the population rather than you know, they moving out to an, is in a way very, very optimistic. I think it was Professor Rayner who talked about the importance of water, and it wasn't touched on last night. And I do agree. I think it's more important in many ways than energy, and inseparable from it. The idealism of Masdar was that you would be able to do everything on site, and it was felt to be a kind of idealistic mantra that it had to be on its own site and sustainable. Well, as part of the experiment, we discovered that that was just crazy thinking, because if you go down into the ground to find the water, to then purify it, take out the salt, and you discover that it's significantly more salty on your site than just down the road, closer to the ocean, where there's less salt, it makes much, much more sense to go down into the ground there and use less energy to purify the water and then bring it. And in Masdar, like in many of our projects, the whole concept of then using the grey water from, you know, wash basins and so on to flush the WCs, it's all in place, but the codes have not caught up with the concept. And it does get a little bit more, and this is not necessarily a showstopper, but it does also get compromised further by religious customs and you know, how, to what extent you can use contaminated water. And again, a lot of the preconceptions, it was almost like an obvious thing. You put the solar cells on the roof. Of course, we also put them on the ground. But we very rapidly discovered that that there are a lot of, whilst it makes a huge amount of sense in a northern climate, in a desert environment, it is really quite problematical to put them on the roof. And as the technology changes, and some of those solar technologies have very, very high temperature liquids within them because of the parabolic heating. And the last thing you want is kind of scalding water above your head. And also, they accumulate dust. And keeping them clean is much more difficult on the roof than on the ground. And so the big generator is really the 10 megawatt generator. But then if you're looking at some of the spin-offs from these experimental projects, you're finding the potential of a 100 megawatt unit, and that's more efficient off the site and feeding into it. So in this other crazy thing, I mean, your point about governance is so pertinent. The oil-based electricity is being sold for half the price of production in Abu Dhabi. So Masdar starts off as an experimental project, and then the kind of austerity crunch, which hasn't hit in any way as hard as here, does change the economic reality of that. So now the solar, which has no subsidies, has to compete against an oil economy in a development. And furthermore, it then becomes subject to the operating financial basis of the utility company, which pays for the investment of burying the services in the road because it's going to make its profit on the tariffs. So if you have something that's so obvious that you put the services where you can get them very easily and don't have to dig up a road, that makes a lot of common sense at a level of logic. But if the governance, if the codes don't follow, so somehow, and I end with some possibilities on that, if they're out of sync. I'll give you another example. 20 years ago, we did our first project in the desert, and we broke through a lot of the conventions around, you know, your chosen object, which is the air conditioner, which I thought was a very elegant way of you know, of introducing that subject. So what we did is heavily shaded tower, and we stuck it on top of a huge block of ice, the biggest block of ice that's ever been made, on the basis that you make the block of ice overnight when the tariff when the electricity is cheaper, because obviously it makes a lot of sense in terms of spreading the load. That's been fantastic until they changed the tariffs. And now it doesn't work on the block of ice because somehow the left hand isn't connected to the right hand. Other things like mixed use, again, the codes, the values, we've only been able to do two true mixed use buildings. And in terms of sustainability, the idea of having something which is flexible, where the rooms can be a hotel, an office, a residence, an apartment, makes a huge amount of sense in the way that you distribute the energy. And the ultimately sustainable building is one that will renew itself over time, doesn't have to be knocked down and rebuilt. And it was a very conservative city government in Cologne that made that possible. So there's a huge development there, the Gerling development that we did. The only other one which is truly sustainable in that way is the one that we did for ourselves at Riverside, where we have apartments above and the office below. In terms of urbanization, I think it was Professor Bannister. Well, one of our advisory board is here, Dr. Mangle. He gave this piece of paper out in our meeting this morning, and he said, I just thought you might be interested in this. I've just come back from a trip. And I'll just read it here. Chinese cities are redefining the scale of urbanization. In the next 20 years, Chinese cities will add more than 350 million people, which is the entire population of the United States. There will be more than 200 Chinese cities with more than a million inhabitants. In Europe today, there are only 35 cities of that size. 35 in Europe, 200 in China. There will be about 50,000 new skyscrapers, the equivalent of building 10 New York cities. There could be up to 170 new mass transit systems. In Europe today, there are about 70. And by 2025, as you point out, in another way, two-thirds of Chinese citizens will live in cities. And that's nearly 1 billion people. I thought that the analogy between the Porsche and the VW of Dr. McCulloch was very interesting and accord really with the Porsche and the VW and the heart unit that that I gave a glimpse of last night, the possibility of an industrialized unit that will treat, in that overused word, a holistic way, all the kind of individual appliances. And I think that that is something that, I mean, we're working on, we're developing. Curiously enough, my car analogy for that was probably the two CV. Interestingly, I showed the Tata, and just before I came here, I had a conversation with Narendra, whose face appeared on that Mumbai project. And he said, you know, the problem with the Tata in India is that this seems like a great economic breakthrough. You can get a four-door saloon for £1,200. And he said, you know, it's probably taken off in a lot of cities, but you never see it in Mumbai, and you never see it in Delhi, because the status symbol of a more expensive car, it carries greater social weight than a Tata. And David Nelson and I went to Shanghai in the 90s and did a project there before it was fashionable for Western architects to go to China. And it was just all bicycles. And he reminded me that we had conversations with the government about their move to change the bicycle to the car. And they agreed privately, but in reality, bowing to, you know, to public opinion, the car was the status symbol. And I think it's very, very interesting, this whole question of the motor city and the traditional city. And I think it was, you're quite right to polarize that, except in the end, I think that the car-based city is really a transient thing, and I think that it's the car will morph into something else, and in terms of sustainability, as I really attempted to show last night, I think that the traditional model is, but then, you know, I think the big conflict with the car as a status symbol in these emerging cities, I think that's really the interesting glimpse in terms of the future. Professor Ogden talked about the federal building in San Francisco and its natural ventilation. And I showed I showed a performance thing last night. What I never really elaborated on was the fact that on the graph, there were two buildings, and they both have similar systems, one a development of the other. One is the Commerzbank in Frankfurt, and that was the first building, with the gardens, the opening windows, natural ventilation. And the development of that is the, as it was so-called, Swiss Re, popularly called the Gherkin since. And on the graph, the Commerzbank is a higher performer than Swiss Re. And the reason is very, very simple, and that is that there is a connection in the Commerzbank between the people who are running it and the concept. And there is no connection in Swiss Re, because essentially Swiss Re, who started off as the owners, it's now a fragmented ownership. And literally, the difference in energy consumption there, which is absolutely dramatic, is that in one building they open the windows and in the other they don't. And they actually open the windows in the Commerzbank because there is a link between the people who use the building, the management, and the fact that they want a fresher building. The environment is actually fresher. I mean, the Hearst building, for example, can use the air for 70% of the time in New York without dramatically cooling or heating. So this link, in the end, I think that that Professor Ockenden talked about the interdependency between architects, engineers, codes, and mathematicians. And I think that in miniature, we have seen in the medical research buildings that we've done at Stanford, the CCSR and the Clark Center, if ever you have a kind of brainstorming session, or you're briefed by the Nobel Prize-winning scientists who can choose their environment and end up directing what kind of environment they research in, their emphasis is on the social spaces, because they make the point that all the great breakthroughs, and the only hope for medical breakthroughs, is that the social space will bring people together from different disciplines and they will interact together, and only in that way do you have the hope for medical breakthroughs. I think that the city of the future, and in a way, I think the promise of this kind of coming together and the provocation of people from different backgrounds, I think the hope is that really those involved with the codes, those involved with city management, those who are coming from the direction of engineering, of architecture, all the specialists, you need that fusion, and with the politicians. That, I think, is the only true hope for the future, breaking down barriers, in the way that the city itself breaks down barriers. And people go to the city because they have more freedom, whether that is political freedom, they have more job choice, they have more likelihood of succeeding. And those cities which seem from the surface to be turmoil and chaos and congestion and polluted, in the end, offer a better style of life and more liberation than the places that they are fleeing to go there. And that is as true of the developed world as it is as the so-called emerging world. If you go to New York, you know, it's booming, it's thriving. You go and other parts of the states. And so that, I think, is a kind of universal message. The hope is in the city, now and in the future. Thank you. Thank you.
M- Many thanks, Lord Foster, for your closing insightful comments. I noted, just as you began to speak this evening, it was exactly 24 hours since you gave your public lecture. So I'd like to thank you personally and also thank Foster and Partners for your very close engagement and I hope fruitful discussions with the university, and we look forward to future events in due course. So thank you very much to you, the Partners, and thank you for all the members of the university and guests of the university today. And I wish you a safe and sustainable travel back through the snow. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't know if you know the artists that you showed with Paddy Fields about outside the Palace of Westminster.